Welcome to the Leader's Edge, where we celebrate leadership and shine a light on the visionary leaders that are shaping our future. Hey, I'm HR Huntsman, founder of Leader's Edge, creator of the Leader's Edge Performance Engine and Leader's Edge University. And I'm thrilled to bring you stories from leaders who are making a difference around the world. In each and every episode, we champion the innovative strategies, courageous decisions, and inspiring journeys of those who lead with purpose and passion. So whether you're looking to refine your leadership skills or you simply want to be inspired, my friend, you are in the right place. Today on the show, we are joined by Panos Chozos, the co-founder and CEO of LearnWorlds. Panos is a fourth-generation educator turned SaaS entrepreneur who transformed a postdoctoral passion project into one of the world's leading digital learning platforms, now serving more than 23 million learners around the world. With a PhD in educational technology and a deep experience spanning software R&D and European policy, Panos brings a rare blend of scholarly rigor and operator-level execution. Under his leadership, LearnWorlds has helped customers generate over $1 billion in client revenue, redefining how businesses and creators scale learning through intelligent AI and immersive course design. Panos is rooted in a long family line of educators and inspired by the Greek tradition of Socratic dialogue. Panos believes learning is humanity's ultimate growth engine, and today he joins us to unpack what leaders often miss about building people, platforms, and enduring organizations. So please enjoy my conversation with learning leader Panos Chozos. Panos, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate your time, my friend.
Hi, HR. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I want to start with one of my favorite topics in all the world. It's one of my biggest drivers, and that is the power of curiosity. Tell me how curiosity has fueled you, your background, and what you're doing at LearnWorlds.
I think it's the biggest strength that a person can have, and it's the biggest driver, at least for me. I'm an ever curious person. Since I remember myself opening books, reading encyclopedias from A to Z, and always trying to have these obscure little snippets of knowledge and gold nuggets of knowledge. But also, I like to make a difference. I like to change things. If I see a little thing dropped on the floor, I want to pick it up and put it in the right place. So I think curiosity needs to be paired with action, also with a drive to change things around you. And I guess this is how we also clicked together with my co-founders and then also with our first employees and the team that we built here, our LearnWorlds. We're very curious, but we also like to improve things and change things. And technology is an amazing asset that allows you to change things at scale and influence tons of people through software that we are building and through the systems that we are building and trying to make a difference in this world of ours.
I love it. I love that you mentioned the encyclopedia. My mom bought me an Encyclopedia Britannica set when I was young. And just like you said, I remember just pulling it off the shelf and just reading it like it was a book and going through and learning about all these things. And every year we'd get the Guinness World Book of Records and I would open it up and see what new records have been set. So I get it. I think curiosity is a powerful driver. You come from four generations of educators and learners. Who really impacted you as a learner and taught you that curiosity is powerful? Where did you get that from?
I think mostly comes from the immediate family and the parents, because I didn't spend enough time with my older grandparents, where they died when I was young. But I guess mainly from my father, I got this urge to always learn and always substantiate what I was saying. Getting asked lots of questions about why I believed something or why I wanted something to be like that, and trying always to find the root causes. And in our house and our immediate environment, the friends, all of them educators, it was having a book as a company was very natural thing. It was the things that you were seeing. So we were emulating as kids the things that we were seeing, always studying, always exchanging. the latest curiosity that we learned or some strange facts, history facts. My father was also a big history buff, discussing about global history and trying to understand how things are happening today based on the knowledge of the giants that were here before us. So I think it worked in this case. I'm not saying that this is a recipe. I'm trying to do the same with my daughter and always ask questions, always push a bit more to not just come back with opinions and beliefs, but also with knowledge and thoughtful answers about the things that are happening around us and trying to explain the world, I guess. It's an important part.
I love it. Now, I'm curious about this next leap. Every time I have a guest on the show, normally it's from producer to entrepreneur. Normally someone's working in a company and they believe they can make widgets better and they start their own widget making company and they go from producer to entrepreneur. You went from academic to entrepreneur. You're a postdoc researcher following a long line of academics. I want to know about that leap off the cliff. What kind of mindset shift did you have to make, if any, to go from a researcher to an entrepreneur?
Great question. So with my two co-founders, we built our very first learning management system, like online course platform. I'm giving away my age here, in 1999. Okay. So that was the point. It was part of an academic project. We built an LMS platform. It was called EduTech 2000, which seemed like a futuristic title back then. Now, I guess it's just it's close to the Y2K problem.
I was going to say the millennial was changing.
Yeah. For those that remember. And we were always very hands-on. It was at that era, there was a resurgence of educational technology. There was always... Education is a kind of an old school model, at least in the way it still happens in this, I guess, industrial model of education, where you have the classroom setting and then you have kids that are coming in, you train them at mass, and then you get them out to the society and to the economy. And people were always trying to find the next gadget, educational gadget that could improve this industrial paradigm. In the past, it used to be 150 years ago, it was educational gramophone. How I can listen to the words of the best professors, that was the means that they had then. And then it was educational radio, and then it was educational TV, which was a big thing in the 50s all the way to the 80s. And then it was the computer, obviously. And then at some point it was the CD-ROM, and everybody was buying these educational encyclopedias and all the things. It was the new version of the encyclopedia in a CD-ROM. So in the beginning of the 2000, it was the internet, it was the new medium that theoretically video was coming along, audio was coming along, even though in very small dimensions and very low resolutions. So it was, I guess, suggesting and creating hopes for something more to come. And we were in a very safe academic environment, working in research projects, publicly funded research projects, creating some great applications along the way. But also increasingly, we were seeing a big disconnect of what was possible theoretically and in an academic setting to what people in the real world had at their hands. So we were designing some great applications that had agents, that had all these little gimmicks, that were using some nice adaptive models of personalized education so that HR or whoever can learn what they need at the right time, at the right place. And then when you were looking outside in the industry, at the school, primary, secondary education, tertiary education, whatever, things were very slow, where still nothing was happening. So at that point, we said, okay, we probably need to do something and create something that is going to be commercial, but also state of the art. So bridge this kind of gap. So it was mostly frustration about this difference of what was possible and what existed out there. After we completed our PhDs and after we also worked in different positions with my co-founders, we saw an opportunity around 2011. George, my co-founder, he was always coming back with plans, and he got us together to see what was possible. If you may remember, that was the time of the big MOOCs, Coursera and Udemy and Lynda, that was later acquired by LinkedIn and is now part of all this LinkedIn training. So these promise of the big marketplaces that any person that wanted to learn something, instead of spending a couple of years in the college and getting into a few tens or hundreds of thousands in debt, they could go out there and just get the knowledge that they wanted in a very fast and actionable way. So this is how we started thinking about this. We said, okay, what's our potential contribution here? Can we create another big marketplace? Do we have the knowledge, the expertise, or the funding, or the connection, the industry connections to create another big marketplace? Udemy or Coursera, does the world need another one? Probably not. But what we could do is create something smaller. We thought about creating the platform for the standalone trainer, entrepreneur, creator who couldn't afford to build his or her own solution, who didn't have any incentive just to publish another course on Udemy that, I don't know, at that point had 50,000 courses. So just another one would probably don't mean much, but they could create their own white label standalone solution, their own shop. So if, let's say, all these marketplaces had the business model of the Amazon, where it's a big marketplace and everybody's trying to sell and compete, and they usually it's a race to the bottom, we said, okay, let's create an experience, a platform that is going to be like Shopify, that would allow the single person, the single provider, the small, medium business that is sitting on a bunch of high quality knowledge, to allow them to package that and sell it themselves to their own audiences and keep 100% of the profit, 100% of the audience. So they will own the audience and they will be able to, let's say, have a white label platform to promote their courses. This is how we started. And this gap that you mentioned in the beginning, we needed some transitioning because there are lots of things that make sense in the academia that don't make sense in the real world. So I have to say that the first iteration of the platform was much more complicated and much more academic, let's say, than users could absorb or tolerate or need or use. So we had to scale that down, and we were lucky enough to find some very strong customers who really knew what they wanted. They believed in the platform. They also understood that we needed some conditioning, let's say, to that direction, but they saw huge potential in the platform. And then at that point, we put a bit the scientist on the back seat. We started learning aggressively from the market. Market needs, user needs. What do these people sell courses? They know how to do it. Let's listen to them. And we were iterating rapidly. And I think over the years, we found the right balance between what makes sense from an instructional design point of view, from a pedagogy point of view, and balance it with real market needs, market traction, the pace and the speed that the market needs in order to produce great results. Because if you have a great product that you cannot distribute, that it will not be accepted, you're not making any difference. It's not going to succeed.
Who's your target market? What's the ideal size business, industry, mindset of the CEO that comes to you and says, we want to create a course? What are we talking about here?
First of all, training is everywhere. This is one of, I guess, like a curse and a blessing for Learnables, because learning fits everywhere. So you can use it as for selling online courses, internal training, external training. But to go to the root of your question, our ideal customers are the ones who are doing training as a business. They create and sell online courses, usually professional online courses, for professional education, accreditation, certification, and this is the best use case. We have also a ton of creators or people who are selling online courses for every subject matter that you can imagine, for self-improvement. It could be photography, it could be fitness, it could be healthcare, anything that you can imagine, but the majority of the use cases, it's about professional accreditation, which could be continuing professional education for all the credits usually that people need to amass and to substantiate the knowledge that has been shared, get some kind of certificate or validation at the end. In most cases, our customers are selling their courses in a B2C capacity, so they do have an audience, and a single person can go in and get a single license because they need to learn something, or in a B2B capacity. Let's say a business that needs to train 50 of their employees on how to use AI for being more productive, and they can go in and buy 50 licenses just for this use case. And that's a model that also fits a lot with all the societal and financial changes, I guess, that are happening in large scale, where knowledge becomes obsolete even faster. The traditional academic organizations are too slow, like, to adapt to the rapid changes that happen on the business scale. Then you have individual providers or small companies who know their business very well and can create some valuable content that shares valuable skills and sell it directly to consumers. So these people usually, they do know their market, they do know their market segments, they do know what needs to be taught, and we are their technology partner. We offer them the platform that will allow them to put in their courses, bring in their own audience, and start making money after even in a couple of days, in some cases.
So I heard two major applications there. B2C, so I own a photography studio and I want to teach people how to do photography. So I come to you, I go to your website, very cool website, by the way, and you have all these templates on there that I can pick from or custom stuff. And I create courses on photography. So HR's photography certification. The one I was thinking of, I'm curious how often it's used this way in, let's say, the mid-sized $50 to $100 million companies. They're doing internal training. So HR training, maybe onboarding, or say the making widgets, here's the HR way of making widgets within HR Inc. You're seeing all the above. What does it actually look like? Let's go to the $100 million company. They have a growth-minded CEO who's all about learning, or maybe the HR director, and they come to you guys and say, we want to create a course internally for our welders so they can improve their welding. What's that actually look like?
It's a great question. I can tell you two use cases for these kinds of businesses. One is the internal training, where you need to teach a person that sits on a particular job role or in a particular location. It could be frontline workers. It could be a remote sales force. It could be partners, resellers, all these different use cases. Traditionally, this is a function that was led by HR or in big organization, an L&D department that goes in. In some cases, they used to take months to create an online course, or in other cases, they were just acquiring off-the-shelf material. They were going to a library of courses or to a large provider, and they were saying, okay, let's get a bunch of courses so that we can train our employees for compliance, code of conduct, cybersecurity, sure. I don't know, soft skills or whatever. Sure. This still happens to a large extent. Usually in these cases, people go in and buy an LMS. What we are saying is that the traditional LMS, learning management system, which is the, let's say, the tool that was used in this space, is there to keep HR happy, not employees. So they need the records, obviously. They need to be able to stand scrutiny. So they need to have all the log files and all the certificates. But the experience is not the kind of experience that today's workers and employees who are immersed in their digital experiences and tablets and iPads and iPhones and all the digital things. Some of these experiences were old school. Like in some cases, you were getting thrown a 100-page PDF answering a couple of multiple choice questions. I'm polarizing a bit. Obviously, there are some amazing platforms out there, but this is what most people had in mind in the big organizations. But right now, with a more flexible, lightweight, let's say, and adaptable platform like ours, it's very easy for the person who sits on a particular job and they know their thing to really create a course by themselves with the help of some AI, with the help of our templates, with the help of our instructional design assistants. The person who is running the machine, the person who is working on the mill, the person who is doing the frontline servicing of the customers, they can go in and share their experience. So this is very genuine, authentic material that really comes from the people who work on that space. Or usually it's a mix, because you can still get some long-term content that comes off the shelf and hopefully has a long shelf life. And then you can also allow people to create material where the knowledge is being created and needs to be consumed. And then there are some more hybrid use cases, which are usually called extended enterprise use cases, where you don't need to train your internal employees, but organizations these days are very hybrid, or they have to adapt. you might have resellers, you might have affiliates, you might have partners, you might have other franchisees who are working next to your own brand, which they are not directly your employees under your HR, but you still need to have some kind of connection with them. And then there's another more clear use case, which is customer education, how you train your customers about your product. You might be selling software, you might be selling widgets, you might be having a complex service that you are implementing, whether it's in healthcare, in banking, in industry, software as a service, whatever. The old way of servicing your customers would be have customer support there, perhaps create a bunch of videos, a customer base, and usually throw people at the problem. But that's not scalable. Right. So this is why customer education, I guess it's the more proactive way of training your customers, making sure that they understand what the product is about, enabling them. And in some cases, we see also companies that certify their users. If you're having a very complex, air conditioning installation or photovoltaics installation, you want to make sure that the people who do that, they have gotten the right knowledge and they have been certified on how to use that kind of material. So this is also some kind of external training. It doesn't involve e-commerce per se in most cases, but still a business might need to train thousands or tens of thousands of external users, and a traditional LMS is not designed for this. It's usually designed just to handle your internal base. And this is where Learnwells excels on this, because we are bringing in this consumer-grade experience, because our customers need to have a great learning experience. They need to enjoy the course. They need to spend the time in there. So we are bringing this experience also into the corporate world.
Let's talk about your own growth as a company, because I'm also curious about leadership. That's what we do every day of our lives. You are now around the world. You're a global company. You have people in many time zones, many cultures. I'm curious about the challenge that was to you. How do you maintain standards? How do you hold people accountable? How do you keep performance high? How do you keep your culture solid? Talk to us about your own leadership development.
Yes, great question. That's something I would like to be able to say that we had a plan from the beginning, but I guess we were figuring it out in the different phases of the company. But I guess some values and some ways of working together that we had since the beginning led to this. I guess it helps a lot that with my co-founders, we had already spent tons of years working in very difficult projects as we were doing our PhDs. We knew how to work together, which didn't require, at some point, it didn't require us even being in the same room. When we started the company, we were living in two different countries, three different cities. So we had to be remote. We had families in different areas. So we were working all day with Skype next to us. The Zooms didn't even exist back then. It was early. Slack didn't exist when we started. So we were over communicating and oversharing and always trying to work together in real time. Because we were a bootstrap company, we couldn't even afford to hire proper employees. So we had talented young people that didn't have any kind of experience in what we were asking them to do, whether it was support, development, but they were inquisitive, they were smart, they were adaptive, and they were very eager to work. An important parameter here is that when we were building the business, it was amidst the big Greek financial crisis of 2012 to 2010 and later. So there was a period of huge uncertainty, huge GDP contraction, unprecedented in non-work conditions, 69% youth unemployment, and we were trying to create a business in this environment. But obviously, that business couldn't cater to the Greek, very small Greek market. It had to be extrovert from day one. Otherwise, it wouldn't survive. So we created this community of always learning, relying on very smart, adaptable, and driven people that are willing to learn and every day discover what is even the right problem to be working on and working together. So, and as the business started growing, then we discovered also a bit the value of compounding, the little things that you can still improving, and at some point you start seeing the return. So let's say the internal motto of our team is getting better every single day. Let's try to push every day to do something better. The learning investing in young talent and taking care also of these people. This is what created this culture, and this kind of individuals thrive also in the business. And as a remote business, we have to over-communicate. We have to be always on, always present. So I guess the traditional corporate ways of working had to be changed for a fast-paced, young environment.
Sure.
So when COVID came along, when we were a remote business in 2017-18, we started talking to some investors for the potential seed funding. We were, as a remote business, we were kind deemed of as unfundable. Like, when are you guys going to be serious? When are you guys going to get together in a in some kind of office and start working seriously? Saying, I'm working 16 hours per day. Like, I can do it from home. Right. I think I can make up for what I'm definitely losing by not being next to the other person. But so that when COVID came along, we were able to scale because we had this DNA, remote DNA, bringing in fast people, giving them small guidance, kind of a framework, and letting them do, you know, their best and getting help and adapting as we were going along. That really helped us scale. And we kept this even after, let's say, post-COVID and after we went into a bigger funding round. So still we are able to attract some amazing talent, wherever they may be. Most of our employees are based in Greece, but not necessarily in Athens. Some of them are in remote islands or small cities. They have an amazing work-life balance. They see us like a global business as an amazing window to the world, because they might be talking to one time zone or one country in 1 minute and then with another person from the other side of the world. And it's a great opportunity for them. And that's how we scaled the business so far. And it works. So I guess we found a balance that works for us.
Good for you. One final question before we run. I always like to ask entrepreneurs this question. If you see, or you work with a lot of young people, so a young person coming out of university or an entrepreneur says, Panos, I want to start my own company. I want to change the world. I want to leave an impact. I want to make a difference. What one piece of business or life advice would you give that young man or that young lady as they're beginning their entrepreneurial career?
It comes, I guess, from my own experience, and we didn't start our entrepreneurial journey just coming out of university. We first got lots of experience out there that really helped. You never know how this experience, where it might come handy or how it will be transposed to something useful. But what I'm getting to is that you cannot really start changing things unless you experience how they are today. Okay. I understand that the drive that people have. And if somebody feels ready to start making these changes and has identified their calling, by all means, I don't want to stop anyone, go out and do it. Most likely, most cases fail, but that's also the risk and the reward that comes along with entrepreneurship. And I don't want to say that people should spend 10 years in some kind of cubicle in an enterprise just to feel the pain and then go out. But you need to have some experiences about the things that you love, that you want to change. So having a passion is not sufficient, even if you love something a lot or a deep knowledge about this. You also need to understand how the world works, how people work, because people skills is going to be a huge part of running a business. Talking with customers, fighting with, talking to an angry customer who has an issue with support and you're becoming their support, talking with potential investors, trying to convince people, pitching everyone that you see around you in an elevator, trying to convince them, hustling. These people skills are something that usually in most cases the technical founders or the people who are the engineers are really underestimating. And also what's important for me is finding the right people next to you as your co-founders. This is not an individual sport. It's a team sport. It's a team of a team marathon. It's not even a sprint. It's a team marathon. So you need to have people next to you that when you stumble, they will pick you up. When they stumble, you will pick up the slack or you will support, because this is a long-term commitment. Could we have been as successful as a business if we took our very first LMS 25 years ago in a different period and somebody had pushed us out of the university to say, go out and make a business? we didn't know how to do it. It wasn't a tradition, let's say, in a Greek university. I think we would probably had failed, because the things that we learned later came together and helped us have this strong bond, and also have experiences that help us overcome the bigger issues. So I guess some experience, some life experience, goes a long way, even when you're trying to do entrepreneurship.
Panos, thank you so much for your time, my friend. I appreciate the wisdom you've shared with us. I wish you greatest success, and I hope we stay in contact as we both grow.
We will. Thanks. So thanks, HR, for having me. It was great being here.
That's it for today's show. Thank you for joining us on The Leader's Edge. I hope today's conversation inspired you to lead with even greater purpose and impact. My big three takeaways from my conversation with Panos are these. Number one, get experience. Try different things. Don't get locked into one thing too early. Gain different experiences that help you become a broad-minded person. Number two, and this is where we began in our conversation, and I can't agree with this more, stay curious. Curious is the fuel that drives me. Panos agreed with that. We all start out as curious kids, but many people lose this along the way. Curiosity drives many of the high-achieving, high-performing leaders that I connect with. Stay curious. Number three, pick your who. Surround yourself with smart, high-energy people, and that kind of tribe breeds success. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I'd love a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us reach more leaders just like you. That's the entire point of The Leader's Edge, to pass on great leadership, because leaders change the world. So stay connected with us on social media for behind-the-scenes content, leadership insights, and updates on future episodes. Check us out at yourleadersedge.com and follow us at Leader's Edge Podcast on all major platforms. So until next time, keep pushing boundaries, keep leading at the edge. I'm HR Huntsman, and I'll see you soon.